This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
This is to stop the wheel. This is how you crank the fire hydrant open to get it to work properly. This is just a light just because.
We're at Kirby Kotler's house at the western tip of Malibu, just south of the Ventura County line. Right now, he's rummaging through some of his firefighting equipment.
And then you got your nozzles, which are adjustable. And they can go really wide like this.
This fire hose in his garage, for instance, it attaches to a hydrant in his driveway, which pumps water from his pool. He says without it, his house wouldn't have survived the Woolsey fire, a fire that burned 100,000 acres in this area 3 years ago.
This is my safe zone right here. It shows where the hose is going, the routes it takes, and what I'm trying to save. So this
as climate change makes fires more frequent and more intense, people like Kotler, who choose to live in fire-prone areas, are getting more creative to keep their properties from burning. Well, today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells walks us through what it actually takes to have a fireproof home and why we don't see more of them here in Southern California.
Kotler is one of those DIY kind of guys. He drives a giant pickup truck with a skull and crossbone sticker on the back. His Mastiff Blue follows him while he wanders around the house he designed himself. When the Woolsey fire threatened to wipe it out, he stayed to fight it.
Okay, so this footage right here are those trees and that palm tree right there during the fire.
Yeah, there we go.
So he was on fire.
House of Kotler, hanging on tight, not letting loose yet.
Armed with a fire hose in one hand and his phone camera in the other, he ran around his property, dousing anything flammable for hours.
It's real now.
That's us.
House has caught on fire a couple times. Put it out.
The video drops out when he turned around and saw the back of his house actively on fire. That job apparently took both hands. In the end, he used about 25,000 gallons of water to save his house, as much as 50 fire trucks can carry. Most of it he got from his 75-foot swimming pool, but he also used two enormous tanks he keeps in his backyard, just in case.
Now you can call me stupid, you can call me irresponsible, but I call myself prepared. I'm not going to leave. I get it. Is your house worth dying over? I would say in a heartbeat, no, but I don't see myself dying here.
He feels safe because he built his house with wildfire in mind. He says he's looked at the mountains behind his house and imagined every scenario millions of times. And he has a plan for every one of them.
I have stucco.
Stucco walls.
I have aluminum.
Aluminum around the sliding glass doors.
Stainless steel.
He's talking about the railing of his balcony. He takes the cushions off his outdoor furniture whenever Santa Ana winds come through. And then there's his landscaping.
I have a huge fire break of 150 feet.
Meaning 150 feet of landscaping between the house and the hillside. Then the plants closest to his house.
It's all ultra lush green. None you could put a light or two and burn, but
those plants are surrounded by lava rock, which is exactly what it sounds like.
This is all lava rock. The next 10 feet is grass and stone. The next 6 feet is concrete wall and concrete wall. And then I come up to really, if you notice, it's sparsely populated with vegetation. That makes it really hard for fire to spread. When it's just a wall of brush, it's good luck. When that catches, all that fuel load's coming straight into your face.
These fireproofing investments might be affordable for someone who can build their own home in Malibu, but they're out of reach for most residents of California's rural fire-prone areas. Kotler pays a couple $1,000s every year to lease those fire hydrants. And he pays another few grand every few years to trim his neighbor's eucalyptus tree to keep it from being a fire risk. He's also got a gardener to handle landscape maintenance. That's not an option for everyone.
None of that kind of stuff was in the budget. So it was just sort of common sense. What's the best we can do with what we have?
Trevor Boehner was the project manager for the construction of a new school building in Ojai. He says the budget was already tight to build a new science center. But then he says the school lost two other buildings to wildfire in 2017.
I mean, the Thomas Fire never actually came up, and the embers were just blowing because the winds were so high, the embers blew from, 3 miles away.
The embers got in under the roof of the 1960s building,
by the time you noticed it was burning inside, it was completely engulfed.
The good news, the new, more fire-resilient design wasn't more expensive to build. And he says if the same embers hit these buildings, they likely would not have burned down.
First off, we just try not to give them a place to land by getting rid of the eaves and using flat roofs and all that. And if they do land, they have nothing to ignite.
The trellises are aluminum, there's no wooden deck, the trees are trimmed and several feet from the buildings, the roofs are flat, and they don't have eaves. Lead project designer Takashiga Ikawa has built houses in fire-prone areas with that same model in mind. It might be safer, but he's not surprised it hasn't caught on with everyone just yet.
Because a traditional sense of the home, like a pitched roof, especially in California, you know, Venice Beach, a lot of the beautiful, cute pitched roof houses. Yeah, people like that.
Local governments have cracked down on building restrictions in fire-prone areas. Some roof materials aren't allowed, driveways need to be wide enough for a fire truck. Fire-resilient design choices might help, but as the climate warms and fire gets worse, it's not always enough to keep everyone safe. Ikawa isn't sure what that means for his future business there.
As fires get worse, and there's this argument that a lot of these places aren't necessarily going to be, like, livable in the future, do you feel like innovation in design is a way to continue to make them livable, or do you feel like it's more just prolonging before it no longer becomes livable? Did that make sense?
It makes sense, but it is difficult because we cannot predict the future, how worse it's going to be, right? Right now, it's still, I believe we can still do it if you properly design the building. It's really how we design the building. But it's a future, if it gets worse and worse, what we can do, we just cannot predict.
And no matter how resilient the property is, homes in some areas can never truly be fireproof. That's the reality Katie Arnaldi has come to terms with. She lives on Point Doom in one of those flat-roofed stucco homes on the same property she grew up on. Some of her neighbors lost their homes in Woolsey. She didn't.
And what I realize now, having gone through Woolsey and we stayed the whole time, is I didn't know anything. And I was just so misinformed.
She had a wood shed on the side of her house and a wood fence. Both of those are gone. She's also got a hydrant hooked up to her pool now, and she's gone through hours of training to identify what might make a house catch fire.
See, one problem is when you become an inspector, all you see is fire opportunity. Like, I walk around, it's like, see that? That's bark mulch. You see that? Right behind you.
But even now that she's something of an expert, she's taking some risks. Her childhood home, situated just beneath where she lives now on the same property, it's incredibly flammable, and it'll probably stay that way.
See, it's tough because it's at the bottom of that gully. That's the danger, is that the fire, the embers get driven underneath that deck, catch on some of that debris, and then the whole thing goes up.
So the house is old. The eaves of the roof are perfect for embers to nestle and smolder. It's surrounded by a beautiful, weathered wooden deck, and under the deck is a giant exposed area with a huge pile of dead leaves. Perfect kindling for wildfire.
So, yeah. I mean, the question could be asked, well, why don't you just maintain this better? Well, it's really hard.
Like hard, expensive or?
Hard, expensive, and nobody's living here. I mean, I can't, we should be, but the whole point is, let's hope the fire doesn't get down here. We can defend our house. Not sure we can defend this house.
Fireproofing her property is an ongoing project for Arnaldi. She might never be able to guarantee her house will survive the next Woolsey fire, but she says she's done enough now that she can sleep at night. And on hot, dry, windy days, there'll always be a part of her that's crossing her fingers and hoping for the best. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Coming up, the Earth's changing climate is on a lot of minds at the COP26 gathering in Scotland. LA's mayor is there, too. You're going to hear from him about the city's plans to make an environmental difference in the years to come. It's on the other side of this on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. A couple of weeks ago, LA's City Council passed a measure calling for the city to be carbon neutral by the year 2030. By 2035, the city wants the Department of Water and Power to provide electricity generated 100% from renewable resources. No coal, no gas. Well, yesterday at the big UN climate conference known as COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced that more than 1,000 cities worldwide have made a pledge to get to net zero emissions by the year 2050. And Mayor Garcetti joins us from Glasgow right now. Mr. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
It's only a couple of days in, but what's the conference been like so far? What have you been up to in Glasgow?
Well, I chair C40 Cities, which is the organization of the 97 biggest cities of the world. About 700 million people we represent, about a quarter of the world's GDP. And we came here meaning business. We wanted to not make pledges, but to show action. And so we went way beyond the 97 cities, and I set a stretch goal about a year ago. I've been working the phones really hard around the world, and we announced 1,049 cities. The biggest pledge outside of the national pledges being made here, we believe at the COP, to get to net zero and to get halfway there by the end of this decade across every continent, rich cities, global south cities, and proof for national governments that you can get there if you focus the way that cities have.
I mentioned DWP and renewable energy coming 100% by the year 2035. That's going to be really expensive to do. The good news is that the city did commission a study that says it can be done, but the bad news is it's going to cost billions of dollars, like $86 billion. Now, the city's annual budget, as you know, is not that high. Where's the city of LA going to get $86 billion over the next 13 years?
Well, the Department of Water and Power's budget isn't a part of that official city budget, and we know that we can finance this. And in fact, the cost of not doing this is going to be far, far greater. Just think about insurance prices for homeowners. Just think about the fires and think about the natural disasters we're seeing in cities around the world. Think about the deaths we have from extreme heat. Confronting this means doing it now and not waiting. And we're confident not only can we finance this, we're finding it's cheaper now to do this than reinvesting in some of the old ways we've been generating power. So we're shutting down 100% of our coal. We're moving away from natural gas and shutting down some of our gas plants and eventually all of them. And we're showing that when we open up some of the largest solar plants in the world, it's actually cheaper than a new gas plant. And the financing is there to do it. You don't think you can electrify your bus fleet? Go to Shenzhen and see 100% electric bus fleet there in China, or at Bogota, where already 1,000 plus buses, or here in LA, where the largest electric bus order was made by the city of LA for our Dash buses. If you don't think you can get to 100% renewable, read our study. A supercomputer with 10 million simulations showed us that it's not only doable, it's affordable, and it will be cheaper in the long term. So we're seeing the proof. So this isn't just about a conference where people promise big things, but where we bring the how, not just the what. And the how is what cities know.
It's not just going to take money to do this, though, Mr. Mayor. It's going to take Angelenos doing something as well, right? There are going to be some behavioral changes that need to be made for this to really work. And, you know, a lot of people are still in their cars on the freeways. How do you change behavior like that?
So I feel great about Angelenos' behavior, though we all need to do more. Angelenos voted for the largest transportation package in U.S. history times two with Measure M, and we're building 15 rapid transit lines. So it's not like winning the lottery if you can take the subway because you happen to be lucky where you live and where you work, but that it serves everybody. We have the most solar installed in America. Has that been a tough lifestyle change? I actually like it, having a lower electricity bill each month. We've installed more public chargers for EVs and put blue EV car shares in our lowest income communities first. So the communities of color and others, and not just the most expensive Teslas on the street, but affordable, shareable cars that are also zero emissions. I think that we overplay how much we have to change our behavior. I mean, think about single-use plastics. We're going to move away from those in Los Angeles. Is considering that legislation, and we went first with straws and plastic bags. We'll keep going forward because human beings have mostly lived without single-use plastics for our entire existence and can easily return to that again. It sometimes takes a month or two to adjust to something new, but when you realize the payoff is that we will have a planet that's habitable, and by the way, a lot of new green jobs, like the 40,000 we've added since I've been mayor, just in these investments, it's well worth it for our economy, for equity, and of course, for our environment.
But what do you say to someone, Mr. Mayor, who can't afford an electric car? You know what I'm saying? It's going to cost a lot of money to switch to the electric car, to put the solar panels on a rooftop. Someone in, you know, Boyle Heights, or someone in the east side or on the west side who maybe doesn't have that kind of money.
I'll say we've got the proof. Join, if you can't afford a car, you can afford a car share through our Blue LA EV program, which is right now on the streets, maybe outside your apartment. If you think you can afford solar, come to us, and DWP has low-income solar assistance. We have things like insulation that's just as important, and we'll actually pay for the insulation in your home precisely because you are low-income and need to be a part of this. We're actually showing the proof that this isn't about how much money you have in your pocket. I think that kind of caricature of the old days where it's only maybe homes on the west side with a $80,000 Tesla and expensive solar panels is changing everywhere. That's how we became the number one solar city in America. We're putting it on businesses, and the businesses are doing it, yeah, maybe for the environment, but also for their bottom line, because we're paying them to be our energy generators on the rooftops of warehouses right here in Basin. So when we look at the ways we can do this, we have to make this across the world, not just inside a city. We have to help the Global South fund this, these immense commitments. America can afford it. Hopefully this infrastructure and reconciliation set of bills will pass soon with a historic investment in climate investments. But we have to help Africa. We have to help South Asia. We have to help Latin America. They're helping themselves too. But if we do that, you know, what happens in Johannesburg matters in Los Angeles. What happens in Mumbai matters to LA. And so part of the message is, what can we do to help fund that, to live up to our commitments as a nation and the richer nations, to make sure this isn't just done in certain places? In the same way we're showing in LA, it shouldn't be done just in certain neighborhoods.
You're not going to be mayor when the rubber meets the road in 2030, 2035. You may be in India at some point. You've been tapped by the president, President Joe Biden, to be the next U.S. ambassador. It's going to take a confirmation, obviously, by the United States Senate to do that. You decided not to run for president because you said you had work to do here in L.A. What about the work that still needs to be done vis-a-vis your perhaps leaving soon?
Well, that day comes sooner or later. My father reminded me, you're never your title, you're just your name. And I'm already in extra time because, remember, when I first ran, I hoped to serve for two terms, 8 years. That date came up July 1st of this past year, but because voters have changed that date, I'm already in extra time in this extra 18 months. When the president called, I just believe when the country calls, you answer that. And I also know how tied we are to the world, including India, that we can't get out of COVID, confront climate change, have an economy that works if we're not, you know, promoting an America that collaborates with partners like India around the world. So, you know, I will be there for some years, but I'll never change the most important title that I have, which is Angeleno, and this will always be home. And I think I will keep that in mind even when I kind of wistfully leave, and I'll miss LA every second, but it's an amazing challenge, an amazing culture, and if confirmed, I look forward to bringing India to LA and LA to India, and also continuing our leadership in the world. And I'm confident that Angeleno's will keep accountable my successor to that global obligation that we have, which is also an intensely local one, to make sure that we win this fight against climate change, against the warming planet, and that we preserve life as we love it and care for it in our neighborhoods.
You lead a city where three of its council members have either been indicted or are serving time in prison for crimes against the people of the city, crimes of alleged corruption and kickbacks. What does that say, do you think, Mr. Mayor, about the city's political environment when there are so many problems that need solving and some politicians are allegedly lining their own pockets? I mean, that's pretty disturbing, isn't it?
100% it is. I mean, it's obviously no majority and a relatively small group of the number of people who commit their lives to public service. But as I've always said, one person can make everybody feel like they don't know if they can trust government. I've seen amazing, committed public servants who sacrifice so much and could earn much more money not being in government, do heroic work. But I think all of us have to call out. It's very sad to me to see, especially, you know, in some cases when I know also good work that people do, but it's taught me people are complicated. People make mistakes. Sometimes people do stupid things. And when they do, as the son of a prosecutor, I've always said, you have to be prepared to pay the price. But it's a reminder for all of us that public service is something holy. If you have that privilege, as I've had for 20 years serving the people of Los Angeles now, which I can't even believe saying it, it's the hardest job you'll ever have, but it's the greatest job. And the only thing that you have is the public's trust. So never take that for granted, never abuse it. And if you do, be prepared to pay the price.
May I ask you one last question about homelessness?
Of course,
before you go? All right. Homelessness is long past a crisis point here in Los Angeles. You can hardly walk anywhere without, you know, seeing human beings living in tents or under benches or tarps. It's heartbreaking every day. We're throwing so much money, hundreds of millions of dollars at the issue through voter-approved taxation. I'm talking about H and Triple H, the measures that have been passed. What do you say to Angelenos who see all of this and are demanding solutions, but they don't see solutions? They just see the problem persisting over and over, and in actually some cases getting worse.
Well, we probably need a half hour to treat this fairly, but let me give it my best, because there's nothing I've committed more time to and taken responsibility for, not causing, but trying to solve, even though the city government is not the level of government that traditionally has the causes into homelessness, nor the responsibility for the cures out. We don't, you know, run the Veterans Administration for people coming home from war with trauma. We don't run the foster care system and the child welfare system. We don't control the prisons where people come out and have faced addiction and mental health issues that never went treated. You know, the things that drive people into homelessness, trauma, meeting high rents. You know, I've tried to pour everything as mayor, and I'm actually quite optimistic this year and seeing finally some rays of light come through the clouds. But I would just beg to differ. We're not throwing money. We're investing money. And I spend a lot of time visiting shelters, tiny home villages, things that didn't exist before I was in the city hall as mayor, together with a lot of other public servants. We've gone to the voters. We have 11,000 units of housing that's coming forward. That's 1,000 more than we promised 2 years earlier for $15,000 less. And I know some of the stories of those people coming off the streets in places like Venice and Echo Park and MacArthur Park and other places along the Arroyo Seco. We've taken dozens, sometimes hundreds of people off the street in just 5-6 weeks, almost all with no conflict. We've had historic investments from the state and the feds, which I've called for a decade, saying we need a FEMA-level response. And finally, they're paying for things like hotel rooms, investing a historic amount from California. And we've stepped up with our own budget, going from $10 million to $1 billion. So one of the things I would write my successor is, you're going to see some good years coming. You're going to see more and more people come off the streets. But if we're serious in this country about ending homelessness and not just reducing it, we need to have a right to housing. We need to have Section 8 or housing vouchers be universal instead of a lottery. With food stamps, if someone's hungry in this country, there's no limit. We say nobody should go hungry. If you need it, you get it. Same thing with Medicaid, which we call Medi-Cal. If you don't have health care and you're poor, you get it. But if you're somebody who needs housing, which, by the way, is the best cure for a lot of medical and mental afflictions, for hunger, for economic depravity, all those things, it's a lottery. 1 in 8 people gets housing assistance from our federal government. So I hope that the package that is before Congress will get passed soon, which will begin to expand. And I had President Biden, when I was his campaign chair, commit to making universal the promise of housing vouchers, which will take some years to get there. But homelessness has been decades in the making, Steve. So I have the same impatience when I see my brothers and sisters, or on my block, which I have, you know, somebody living in a tent, or somebody struggling with mental health affliction on the streets. But I would just say, it's not that the car doesn't work and we need to get out of it. We need to keep accelerating now that we finally built it, have some, you know, fuel in the tank, and let's get to where we all want to be, a city where no one is unhoused.
Mayor Eric Garcetti joining us from Glasgow, Scotland, at the COP conference. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
As always, thank you, Steve. Appreciate you.
Na na na. It's Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. It has probably happened to you before. You're standing on the beach, staring out at a beautiful sunset, and you spot something in the receding tide. Trash. Maybe it's a straw, maybe it's a can or a plastic bag. Ugh. It probably bums you out, and it should. Ashley Bickerton, however, picks up that trash, which is nice, and he makes it a part of his art. Bickerton creates colorful seascapes with man-made debris washed ashore, and you can check them out at various Small Fires, which is an art gallery here in L.A. Lindsay Preston Zappas is the founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. She joins me right now to talk about that solo exhibition. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us about Bickerton. He was born in Barbados. He grew up in Hawaii. He went to school here in California. I assume living along so many coasts informed his art, right?
Yeah, I think ultimately, yes. His father was also a linguist and an anthropologist, so they traveled around quite a lot in his childhood. But I do think he's been drawn to the ocean, and his new work he's making certainly reflects that. He's also a surfer, so he moved from New York back in the 90s to kind of escape the city and be closer to nature in Bali.
And probably as a surfer, he has seen a lot of trash in the water, too. So I want to start with one section of the show called the Flotsam series, which really showcases this ocean trash. Where does he find it, and what does he do with it?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to that kind of narrative you were spinning at the beginning here, Steve, about him kind of walking along the beach. He was walking with his wife in Bali, and he was noticing how the waves would leave these kind of trails of sea debris, or flotsam, as it's called, on the shore, that kind of become these little records of where the waves have been and sort of form these really nice lines across the sand. But he noticed that these little trails of debris were made from, you know, a little bit of natural items like shells or pebbles, but also man-made items, right? Like microplastics and trash that would kind of form these rows across the sand. So this kind of visual inspiration really kicked off the series. And Bickerton finds all the objects he uses in Bali that kind of get washed up on the shore. And a lot of the objects he finds are plastic, right? So like flip-flops, toothbrushes, lighters. Some of them we can't quite name, but they're kind of in the works. All these little plastic bits and bobs. And he compresses them into compositions that kind of mimic those flotsam trails. So they have these kind of linear rows that flow across the compositions. And behind the compositions of objects, he paints these really bright landscapes. And then he frames them in these heavy metal frames. So they almost have this feeling of time capsules, like he wants his junk preserved forever for future generations.
There's also a sculpture, Lindsay, called Floating Ocean Chunk, which I guess you can describe it as this glass aquarium that's suspended in the air by rock climbing gear, right? We're talking about like carabiners dangling from the bottom and, you know, flags draped from it. What's going on with that exhibit?
Right. So for these floating ocean chunks, Bickerton casts resin into these cubes, and there's kind of this swirl of blue and white and some darker chunks within that. So it almost looks like some kind of industrial produced cross-section of like the ocean itself. It has this kind of swirling sensibility to it. And then he places that big chunk within all these objects you've described and kind of creates a swarm of materials. So for me, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is that Great Pacific Garbage Patch, right? Which is kind of elicited with this work, and the title Floating Ocean Chunk, I think, kind of points to that. But Bickerton also, if we kind of look back at kind of where he came up as an artist, he was a contemporary of artists like Jeff Koons and Haim Steinbach in New York in the 1980s. And they were kind of reacting to this genre of abstract expressionism by focusing on really slick finishes, industrialized kind of commercial goods and commodities. And, you know, thinking about some of Jeff Koons' early works where basketballs and vacuums were displayed in these kind of hermetically sealed acrylic boxes. So, you know, Bickerton's a very different artist than Jeff Koons, but I think there's an element of this slickness and commercial products being used as an aesthetic object that's in the work. And I think with this piece, that's where the ropes and this climbing equipment, these aren't used objects. They're kind of new purchase commodities that are making it into the work.
Is he an environmentalist? Is that what's going on here? The fact that, you know, he finds his trash on the beach.
Yeah.
He's trying to make a point.
You know, I think the work definitely can be read that way, but he's not, he's like very much not an environmentalist and has said that in interviews. And I think in other work of his too, he kind of deals with issues that could be perceived as critiques of culture or climate change or politics. But then he always does this thing where he kind of steps away. He like steps off the gas, or he doesn't want any overt reading or message. But he's even gone so far as to talk about ocean trash as being beautiful and kind of like part of the natural world, which is kind of interesting and slightly disturbing. But, you know, I think more than an environmental perspective, he's interested in what all this trash and detritus represents, like thinking about all of the lives that these objects have been a part of and the culture that's created them. And he kind of wants to preserve these objects as, again, these little time capsules to kind of show this moment that we live in. So I think there's more of a sort of zoomed out existential point of view and maybe even a little nihilistic, I would say, more than environmental.
Well, Bickerton's solo exhibition is called Landscapes, Seascapes, and Interiors, runs through November 6th. At various Small Fires, the gallery over on Highland Avenue. Lindsay Preston Zappas from Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's all the time we have for today. Check out the podcast online when it drops in a few hours. There, a bonus segment. What? Where you can hear about the artist Ashley Bickerton, who not only picks up trash along the beach, but he also makes it a part of his art. A big exhibition over at the various Small Fires gallery here in L.A. Check out kcrw.com/GLA. where Lindsay Preston Zappas had a first look and talks more about it. That's at our website. Tomorrow, a new episode talking to some folks in South L.A. who live near an active oil drilling site. Derricks and wells among the trees and shrubs and densely populated apartment buildings. And the fight to get some of those wells capped. Check out the show. Grab the podcast, too. kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barr, and Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.